Frippin' Sylvian, Brightness Falls, which may be appropriate for discussing corporate media in America today. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. You're tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. On the line, we have Randy Baker with us, who is the co-producer of Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, as well as the writer of the documentary. Randy, thank you for being with us.
Nice.
Well, I'm certainly glad you were able to be with us. Of course, we had been talking with your co-producer, Beth Sanders, about the film, and we were expecting to have her on, but she arranged to have you there, and I'm really glad for that. So thank you once again. Can you let the listeners know about Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, and then we can talk about how you came to be doing this, and then also how the filming went and what the reaction has been since filming?
Fear and Favor in the Newsroom is an hour documentary about, well, I guess I'd call it self-censorship in the mainstream press. And by self-censorship, what I mean is the way the organizations, the top down in these organizations, the owners in particular, cause journalists, not through handing them lists of stories or statements they can't publish, but nonetheless, the ways, kind of subtle ways, they cause journalists to refrain from covering stories that disclose unflattering material, shall we say, about large corporations. And what we show is, you know, we're kind of proving a negative in a sense, because there is no written list or law in any of the news organizations that you can't cover this. And in fact, some news unfavorable about corporations does get published. What we do is we trace kind of critical moments in the careers of some extremely well-respected and accomplished journalists such as Sidney Shanberg or Jonathan Quitney working at, you know, the most respected mainstream news organizations, the New York Times, McNeil, Lehrer, NBC News. And we show that basically, what happens to these journalists when they go after tough stories about corporate power, or for that matter, sometimes about the United States government or other powerful government officials, instead of getting rewarded, you know, when they dig up, say, interesting facts, they're, well, sometimes they're punished. Other times, their stories just aren't so well received. But when they keep doing it, the point is, it's not that if you write one story and the owners don't like it or the senior editors don't like it, your career is over. But if you keep doing that, and if you're a good journalist, that's going to happen because everyone has discrediting things about them, especially the powerful. If you keep doing that, your career is really going to suffer. And we show people getting fired, like Sidney Shanberg. We show stories getting censored on nuclear power at McNeil Lehrer and the New York Times. And you know, I think we show enough at enough major news organizations that viewers are going to see that the kind of common image of the journalist as, you know, someone who really is going to make their career by felling some wealthy or powerful person or institution, that's not really the way it works.
We're talking with Randy Baker, co-producer of the documentary Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, as well as the documentary's writer, I might add. Randy, let me ask you this, because when you talk about these journalists, I mean, what do they say when someone tries to point out to them, hey, look what's happening here? I mean, what is their response to that?
Well, I'm not sure how you're posing the question. What is it that you're suggesting they should react to?
Well, I'm suggesting that if you can look at the situation and you say, well, gee, I can see how they're self-censoring and how they're shying away from covering important stories that may affect people who are paying their bills, in essence. I mean, that if you can see that, I assume that these people who are doing this are reasonably intelligent people. And I'm just wondering, when you were filming this, I mean, did you ever have the opportunity to say, you know, gee, it really seems to me like you're backing off on these types of stories, and I just wonder what their response was, whether it was one of, well, no, I'm not doing that, or one of, you know, well, yeah, but I got to save my job because my kids got to go to college.
Well, it's fascinating because almost all the journalists we interview in the documentary, and we interview quite a few of them, are ex-journalists, or at least they are talking about news organizations with whom they're no longer employed. Sidney Shanberg, when I interviewed him, was employed at Newsday. He had been fired from the New York Times. Frances Serra was self-employed with her own on-web Line magazine. She was no longer an investigative reporter at the New York Times. She had been frozen out. Peter Grauman, when he gave us his footage that was censored on McNeil Lehrer on a nuclear waste facility in Southern California, he was no longer employed there. And these journalists were quite forthcoming. Their point of view, I would say, is not very different than the one I reached in making the documentary, which is, yes, indeed, there are limits. Yes, I did get into trouble for crossing those limits. Was I a good practicing good journalism? Yes. Should these limits have been there? No. So for the working journalists we interviewed, almost universally, Jonathan Quitney, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, who lost his investigative series on public television, the same thing. You know, they were doing stuff that often was unflattering to the powers that be, and so they couldn't, you know, keep doing it. They couldn't get paid for it. Now, we did interview some of their ex-employers. And interestingly, in the case of the New York Times, I interviewed Sidney Grusin, who was previously the vice chairman of the New York Times company and indeed was the man who fired Sidney Shanberg in the mid-'80s. And Grusin, I don't think he had gone on record prior to the documentary as acknowledging this, but he said, well, you know, Sidney was writing, he wrote a column that implied the New York Times was venal. Shanberg had been writing columns on corruption in New York City, in the real estate business, in the government, in building highways, things like that. And Shanberg had mentioned, without naming the Times, that the press was in effect complicit because they were, you know, they were ignoring it. They were writing frivolous stories on, you know, some guy opening a new restaurant, Shanberg points out, too. But they wouldn't cover the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars to, you know, stuff the pockets of contractors and corrupt government officials. So anyhow, Grusin just said, look, we don't have to put up with that stuff. He implied we're venal. He can say that anytime he wants, but he's not going to do it as our employee. So sometimes we got kind of, you know, frank acknowledgments like that. But in other cases, you know, we had a former publisher at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who's now a vice president of the firm who owns them, Cox Enterprises. We had Michael Gartner, who at the time was president of NBC News, and they said, hey, you know, we're straight ahead. There's no censorship here. We don't put any pressure on anybody. You know, we tell them like it is.
And when they made those statements, I mean, were they, I guess what I'm really getting at is that, from my perspective, and we've had journalist Gary Webb on the program, also Bob Perry, who ran afoul of even more powerful entities in the CIA, and I've seen what's happened to them. And I guess what I'm asking, Randy, is that we had our local publisher on at one point in the past, and he really seemed to me as though he didn't understand why there was a problem with doing the kind of, I think, censorship and pro-corporate kind of reporting, either by, you know, commission or omission, that this was just sort of a natural, okay thing. And I guess that's what I'm trying to find out. I mean, don't these people realize how they're betraying the public by doing what they're doing? I mean, are they in denial, or do they just not care, or
well,
what?
You know, I think it's closer to not care. I mean, you know, the Constitution protects the press, right? It doesn't protect other businesses, just the press, and that's not an accident. If you're going to have a real democracy, if the public is really going to, you know, have some substantial say in what is done to it, you've got to have a press that's free to go after the guys in power, whether it's private power or public power. Otherwise, you know, they're going to run things. Now, if you are a senior executive or an owner of a major corporation, and one source of income happens to be a news outlet, or for that matter, if you own it because you enjoy venting, as was more common in the old days with, say, the old Hearst newspapers, venting your own worldview, you're not in the business of journalism to execute this constitutional function of checking the powerful. You're in the business of journalism maybe to make money, which is all well and good, or to vent your own views, and that's all well and good, too, except when you happen to own one of the key organs on which the public depends for being informed, and furthermore, you represent yourself to the public, and I think in the case of the major news media, with a great deal of success, as being objective and fair, well, then you're doing a great deal of public damage, I think.
We're talking with Randy Baker, writer and co-producer of the documentary Fear and Favor in the Newsroom. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. You're tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-FM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. Randy, we had Bob McChesney on a couple of months ago, and one of the things that he was talking about is that what's happening in the media, I mean, is really endangering our democracy, because you can't have a public who is supposed to make decisions making those decisions when the information that they're getting has holes in it, or when it's biased in favor of the powerful. And I mean, and do you see this problem of what you've exposed in Fear and Favor in the Newsroom as getting worse? I mean, I know I do.
Absolutely. The only thing I would caution, and I think Bob McChesney also cautions about this, I think we see it fairly similarly, is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion of CBS has been taken over by a conglomerate, Westinghouse, NBC is now owned by one of the largest defense contractors, General Electric, and ABC is owned by Mickey Mouse. You know, that is making things worse, absolutely. But, you know, if I could use an analogy to grading, when CBS was owned by itself, when ABC, you know, was owned by whoever, a smaller conglomerate, they were not doing what they were supposed to be doing. I would say then the press was doing a C-minus job, and now it's doing a D-minus job. The point is, this problem of relying on almost exclusively government sources or high-power corporate sources or sources that are from major foundations financed by large corporations, that's been a problem with American journalism for decades, and it's simply getting worse, and the news is getting more frivolous, or perhaps the news is being, you know, changed to infotainment entirely. But in terms of giving voice, you know, allowing a plausible accounting from the other side, the press has always been terrible about that. And I think one point we show that very well, I think, in the documentary is the story we show of Peter Grauman, a McNeil Lair reporter who covered this waste facility I referred to earlier in Southern California. Now, you know, McNeil Lair, PBS, they're not owned by a conglomerate. They're probably one of the more serious and sober mainstream news organizations. Grauman went down there, and there was a controversy. Should we have this radioactive waste facility here or not? So Grauman reports both sides. He shows the guys building it, U.S. Ecology, the government, think it's a great idea, it's safe, it's environmentally responsible. Well, he also shows the other side. The other side says, this isn't safe, these things leak, you know, we don't want radioactive stuff in our farms, our homes. When Grauman looks at the report as it was broadcast, he finds it was radically edited. And the parts that were edited out were the parts showing the three other radioactive waste facilities built in the country, two of whom had been operated by the same firm that wanted to operate this new one, they all leaked. They were on Superfund's list. They were being sued by states for leaving, you know, radioactive waste leaking into water supplies. That was cut out. He also had footage of what the facility looked like. Well, the facility was an open pit in the ground. That was the facility. So that gets deleted. And so for the opponent side, all you see are some people standing around with signs saying, we don't want the dump. Well, they look ridiculous. It looks like if you're opposed to the dump, you're just some, you know, semi-literate fool standing around with the sign who doesn't understand all the science. And that wasn't the truth. And that wasn't his story. But that's what viewers saw.
Well, that brings me to the whole issue of so-called public broadcasting, because as public broadcasting, PBS, NPR, becomes more dependent on a big and increasingly, I think, more conservative types of foundations. And when you have, for example, several years ago, Bob Dole putting pressure on NPR saying, you know, I'll pull your funding if you air Mumia Abu-Jamal or whatever it is, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to ask you, Randy, is this, that, I mean, we expect this from, you know, corporate private enterprise on some level. But then you have this whole realm of so-called public broadcasting that is supposed to be the place where the other side does get discussed. And from what I'm hearing you say is that it's not getting discussed. In fact, it's getting actively sabotaged. And as I understand it, that has also happened to you and your co-producer, Beth Sanders, regarding Fear and Favor in the Newsroom. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, yeah, I think in one case it's very clearly documented. In our case, I would say we just have very strong circumstantial evidence, shall I say. You know, it's the movement rightward towards kind of a conventional corporate status quo in NPR and PBS, not that they were ever great, although NPR at one point, maybe a couple decades ago, did seem to have some real freedom at points. You know, it's been collapsing, and it's quite obvious that there's a direct connection between the radically increased reliance on corporate funding and the political content. I mean, you could see even the commentators they're using and not using. There's been a shift. It's almost like, you know, James Aronson, a former New York Times journalist, once explained how the Cold War impacted the Times, and there was just this one fact he noted that just shocked me, which was, in the early 50s at the New York Times, there was a small group of China experts who they relied on to comment on China prior to the beginning of the official kind of Cold War. And they would produce, I don't recall his figure, 50 or 100 comments a year between them on China. And after, you know, the Cold War, and there had, you know, the resulting kind of implicit and explicit censorship, these guys produced like 3 reviews on China. They were no longer on the authorized list of people to talk about it because their viewpoints weren't, you know, properly consistent with the government line. Unless NPR and PBS have non-discretionary government funding, non-discretionary so that it doesn't matter what Bob Dole feels, and unless they're totally cut off from any corporate funds, so, you know, I don't know what people have talked about, viewers can give up to $100 or something, unless it gets put back on that kind of footing, then there's no way that they won't be controlled in the same way that the corporate press are to reflect corporate viewpoints. And as for our own documentary, all I can tell you is describe as an astonishing series of coincidences, which makes me believe that indeed the content, which is in large part discrediting to large corporations, affected our fate. We were denied assistance repeatedly from Point of View, which both finances and broadcasts independent documentaries on public television. In the early 90s, I met with the executive director of Point of View, Mark Weiss, who, in fact, I believe personally is not necessarily opposed to the kind of documentary we made. But nonetheless, I think if you look at what's on Point of View, it rarely discusses corporate power in the United States, even though that's an obvious issue that a documentary would address. He looked at our funding clip, which showed a couple interviews with journalists, and afterwards he said, you know, we're not going to support that because we want the kind of programming that's going to be well-reviewed in places like Redbook, which I later learned is kind of a grocery store magazine, hardly the kind of thing that you should feel you have to satisfy in order to you know, present a documentary to the American public on television. We got virtually no funding from any major foundation. We got a lot of tiny foundations that did support us and individual contributors and gave us donations. We went back to them over and over to finish it. My co-producer, Beth, had made a documentary years ago, which won a regional Emmy in Chicago when it was broadcast. So then when we neared completion, we went around to some PBS affiliates, stations for just to use their editing facilities to finish it. The station we won the Emmy didn't want to touch it. Our local station, then KQED in San Francisco, wouldn't even give us an answer. A small station in San Jose, KTEH, did come forward, gave us their editing facilities, completed it. No interference with editorial content whatsoever. Then they tried to send it up on PBS. PBS refused it, even though it now had, you know, the credibility of a PBS affiliate, at least in a middle-sized city. They sent it to the second fish in the public broadcasting chain, something called American Program Service. They said they wouldn't broadcast it because it wasn't balanced enough. finally, the smallest fish in the chain of sources of programming to the 300 PBS affiliates around the country agreed to satellite feed it next month. Now, what it means, aside from lack of compensation to the producers, that the littlest guy on this chain, rather than the biggest, the public broadcasting system, chose to send it out, is the likelihood of any individual affiliate picking it up radically declines. They have prestige and money incentives to go ahead and accept broadcasting from PBS, the big fish, but not necessarily the little fish. If they do pick it up, the likelihood they'll show it in prime time declines. So, you know, we have gotten through a crack in the system. People are going to see it, at least some people, but obviously I don't think as many as are warranted by the reception the film receives when people actually view it.
We're talking with Randy Baker, writer and co-producer of the documentary Fear and Favor in the Newsroom. My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. You're tuned to community-supported radio, KVMR-AFM, Nevada City, Auburn, Sacramento. Randy, let me ask you, because, I mean, that's another aspect of this, that Fear and Favor will be available to PBS television stations, but do you have any idea at all how many are planning to run it? Because, I mean, let's face facts. I mean, I don't know necessarily how their system for sharing programming works, but golly, I mean, they've got enough cooking shows on and enough home improvement shows. I mean, there seems to me that there's, you know, they could make some room for this. Do you have any idea how many intend to do that? And in particular, whether or not KVIE, our local PBS station, has any plans to let its viewers see Fear and Favor?
I have only the faintest idea. To be fair to the affiliates, they're under no obligation or even an expectation to contact the producers about their decision. They're dealing with this little fish in the national feeding system called National Educational Television Association. However, there has been an internet campaign to encourage people. I should add that campaign has been organized by a media activist group in Seattle called Citizen Vagrom, because Beth and I are clueless about the internet. They have been letting people know about the documentary. They've even done an interview with us, and it's on their website, and they show clips of the documentary. But they've been letting people know about its existence and letting them know that if they want to see it, they're going to have to contact their local PBS affiliate and really let that affiliate know how important it is that the show get broadcast, because there is this, you know, mainstream inclination they have to overcome to avoid programming like this. We do know, aside from San Francisco and San Jose that have shown it, that Seattle, Hawaii, and St. Louis have said they definitely will broadcast it. That doesn't mean other cities aren't, but, you know, I suspect on the one hand, cities are not, the programmers are not falling all over each other to pick it up. On the other hand, I do have the impression that there really is quite a bit of activity already by people who have heard about it around the country asking programmers to show it. So I actually do anticipate it getting on quite a number of affiliates, but I have no way of knowing at this point how many, and I am confident that without public pressure, very few affiliates would show it.
Well, it would seem then that if people in our local listening area were wanting to see Fear and Favor in the Newsroom on our local PBS station, KVIE, that the best thing they could do would be to call the station up and inform them that they would like the opportunity to view this documentary.
I think that would be a good idea. I think it might also be useful if they were so inclined that they could inform their programmer or station manager, but probably the programming director, that the signal is being broadcast by NITA on November 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
And that date again?
Sunday, November 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
We're talking with Randy Baker, co-producer and writer of the documentary Fear and Favor in the Newsroom. Randy, we just have a couple of minutes left, and I guess what I'd like to ask you is, having done the work that you've done on this documentary and all that you've gone through to produce it, what is it that you would like to leave our listeners with so they would have an idea of your feelings about the importance of all of this?
Well, If the documentary did what I hope it will do, or at least encourages what I hope it will encourage, I think people will recognize that they have to organize perhaps as much or more than on any other issue, on the issue of institutionalizing an independently financed large media in the United States through non-discretionary government funding. I think if we don't have that, redressing the gross inequalities of wealth and power, cleaning up the environment, taking control of our government, that is all going to be impossible unless we have a media that is not in the control of the people running things right now.
Randy Baker, writer and co-producer of Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, possibly available on your local PBS television station, coming up shortly if you were to let them know that you wanted to view this documentary. And I've seen the clips on the Free Speech TV website, and I think it's well worth everybody's viewing. Randy, thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.